That's Eliades Ochoa. You may recall him from the Buena Vista Social Club and his Grupo Patria from Cuba, collaborating with some of the finest acoustic musicians from Mali on Al Viven de mi Carreta, a cart driver's lament about a hard life. So that's Eliades on vocals and acoustic guitar, Kase Madi Diabate on vocals as well, you'll hear him soon, Osnel Odit on acoustic guitar, Jilimadi Tunkara on electric guitar, Tumani Diabate on kora, fantastic musician, Fode Lazana Diabate on balafon, Jose Angel Martinez on double bass, and Jorge Marturel on congas and bongos. A wonderful project called Afro-Cubism, the Africans and the Cubans together, with on this release in 2012. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Tuesday, April the 15th, a very taxing day, if you know what I mean. Ha, 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 ha. Oh, I amuse myself. Well, I wanted to talk about the role of media in a vastly changed world in the United States, of course, around the world. But we can talk a bit about that, the beast that we know. And we know the beast is, we know the U.S. media quite well. Why is this coming to me now? Well, I've been observing, of course, coverage over the past several months. And it was astonishing to me that there are so many lines of demarcation that it is hard now to recognize even the so-called, quote, liberal media. I don't know who those are anymore. But the coverage that we get hasn't really moved at all from the locus of the 1950s and 60s. When President Lyndon Johnson commissioned the National Advisory Commission on Civil Disorders, also known as the Kerner Commission, because it was headed by Governor Otto Kerner of Illinois, he commissioned this group, 11 members, to undertake an understanding, to undertake some kind of research into the causes of urban rebellions that had been occurring with alarming regularity during that time. At the time that he commissioned this group to study these social phenomena, there was rioting going on in Detroit, and we had also rioting in Chicago and the Watts riots of Los Angeles, the Newark riots of 1967, and there was a lot of an exp- just an explosion of violence. And of course, it was very scary to everyone because they'd never seen the war in Vietnam was ongoing, but that was over there. But it looked like a war was unfolding over here, and in the United States, it's been too close for comfort. The good thing was, and I use the word good in a sarcastic way, the good thing was that these rebellions were occurring in communities that were easily contained by police and other law enforcement agencies. The good thing was that they were in a way a very good opportunity for the state to demonstrate its control over these communities, and by extension, people like those living in those communities, wherever they were in the United States. The good thing was that the awesome power of the state essentially was called upon to restore order. And that was the main thing, to restore order. Because after all, the United States, a world leading nation, the leading nation of the world, the boss of the world, how could it have such a divided society? How could it possibly have the same contradictions that it points out in other countries? And this was a huge embarrassment to the United States, because at that time, too, we had these ideological differences playing out on the world stage, where capitalism was battling communism in other people's countries. But here was a case of the rebellion was literally in your house, and you have to fix it somehow. And fix it in a way that sends a message to the world that even in distress, even in situations where we have these so-called riots and misbehavior by people, and of course the black people, the response was unusually patient and unusually respectful of people's rights. So it was a kind of dance that the United States did. The law enforcement communities sent to quell this. At the same time that they had to show force, they also could not be seen as violating the citizens' rights, because in effect it would have been visually communicating civil war. So they managed this very, very well. The newsrooms of America at that time were almost all white. In fact, they were all white, to be very frank about it. And you had the first time that the black press was almost put out of business, because the white media raided the black newsrooms of the black newspapers and got their best talent and took them in, with the promise, of course, of higher pay and another degree, with the promise of greater prestige. Now you could put on your resume that you work for the New York Times. That in and of itself is a holy grail of journalism, wasn't it? So they raided the black newsrooms to such a degree that newspapers almost collapsed. And they never quite recovered from the constant raiding of their newsrooms. Why? Because these stories were occurring in parts of the United States that they were reluctant to send white reporters into, fearing for their safety. And besides, there was such a divide, a cultural divide, The feeling was black folks would understand the language of black folks. So you send the black people in to talk to the other black people. And hopefully that gives them the advantage, because now they can't ignore the story anymore. They've been successful at ignoring the dramatic deterioration of urban areas and black communities for a long time. These communities were not on the map, except when the media needed to illustrate what pathology looks like. When you study crime and murder and you study the pathetic existence of people, you foray into the African-American community to get that kind of story. And it would be given the predictable treatment. Here they are, these folks who just, no matter what we do, they just won't help themselves. These stories were written from a point of view, for the most part, of looking at these communities, the African-American communities, Latino communities, as, you can say, like petri dishes full of bacteria. And the point of these stories was to basically contain the bacteria, to assure the rest of society that the bacteria were safely contained. They'd put them under the microscope to look at the level of pathology occurring in these communities. And that, for the rest of the country, there was a certain sense of satisfaction. Well, at least I'm so glad we are not there. It's okay if it happens to them, as long as it's not happening to us. And the media basically fed into this supremacist notion that there were different kinds of people in America who ought to be treated differently because they don't really measure up to being Americans. In fact, it's a carryover from that famous Dred Scott decision. Really, you're really not a person. And that, as recently as the 1960s, 50s and 60s, and early 70s, was a prevailing view in most newsrooms. The New York Times, for example, and many of the newspapers in major cities, didn't even have circulations in black communities. They weren't even on the newsstands in these communities because, frankly, they did not want these people reading their newspaper. It's like the time when it was discovered that Mercedes-Benz did not want any ads showing African-Americans associated with their product. Until, of course, they took a look and they saw how much money they were deriving from that community. And they sort of gave way a little bit, but not too much. What I'm pointing to is that the media is an instrument of socialization. It is an instrument also of social control. It is also an instrument of psychological conditioning, because the people who determine what news is, what we read and see and hear on a daily basis that we consider to be news, the gatekeepers of that kind of information generally do not resemble the population. They are extensions of the elite of our society. And as allegedly open-minded as they are, they still maintain these white supremacist views, and it's very hard to shake them. How do we know that? Because, of course, the Kerner Commission itself said that the news media, news organizations, were in fact responsible for the conflagrations that occurred in the 1960s by ignoring the stories that were so obvious about the inequities, the racism, the trenchant racism in our society, by refusing to cover fairly the issues that were important to these communities. The Kerner Commission had a very scathing, dedicated a very scathing part of its report to news media and how it functioned. So that was one of the unintended benefits of the civil rights era, if you will, when all these things were happening in these compact, densely populated urban areas, in cities all across America. There was this feeling of unease. And more than that, of course, it's interpreted as a feeling of threat. And so how do you control this? According to the Kerner Commission, they felt that fair reporting was important. They actually said that the media were covering the world from the white man's point of view. That's what they said. And they recommended that newsrooms do something to diversify their workforce, and that they understand or get to understand the cultural changes and the cultural realities of the country, that in fact that they undertake a dramatic change to understand the communities that they were covering. That was assuming that they had an interest in covering these communities. You can see lately there are a couple of references I'd make to this, how the realities in these communities are so different from the realities in other communities. One is Snowden, for example, Edward Snowden. Someone had written me about Snowden bringing to the fore the importance of the Fourth Amendment. And, you know, that was a great thing. And never before had he, you know, we really appreciated the value of the Fourth Amendment. And to my mind, and I had said it from the very beginning, this is an old story about the security state and how it was encroaching on the rights of individuals. And the story that I illustrated to him in responding to him was the seminal case that tested the Fourth Amendment was of an African-American woman in Ohio named Dollree Mapp. She ran a boarding house, and police officers swarmed her home looking for an alleged bombing suspect, and they located the room where he was supposed to be. They took up a whole bunch of items, including one pornographic magazine. And next thing you know, Dollree Mapp was facing all kinds of charges based on things that they gathered from his room in her home as a boarder without a warrant. Now, that occurred in 1957. And that was a reality for most African Americans back in 1957. So when this comes about, Snowden and his information comes around, and people are talking about the value of the Fourth Amendment, there are two entirely different points of reference here. We have the story recently of Al Sharpton, and people were talking, it's this great story that broke just last week about Al Sharpton and wearing a wire for the federal government. Well, it might have been news to most people, but that was news back in the 1980s in the African American community. It was we were stunned that people thought that this was news. This was dealt with in 1980s. In the 1980s, in Bedford-Stuyvesant and in Harlem and in other black neighborhoods in New York City. This was a big story then. But because there is no cultural contact, and because there is no sense that you have to respect or even be interested in a world outside your own, this information is never transmitted back and forth because the operative view is it isn't real until somebody white says it is. So we have to wait for Mr. Snowden to tell us about the importance of the Fourth Amendment and not the Dollery Map case of 1957. We have to wait till the story breaks about Al Sharpton when we know we've been dealing with that since 1985. So what is this role of the media? The newsrooms today have improved a bit, but not much, according to the American Society of News Editors. Not much. It doesn't look anything like the cultural composition of the country. So the people who are covering news, for the most part, are covering it from a vantage point of as a member of the larger, quote, more powerful group, unquote. They don't understand culture. They don't feel a need to understand culture. Back in 1975, 76, somewhere around there, I did a five-part series on Crown Heights called Crown Heights, A Lull Before the Storm. It was so evident to me that Crown Heights in Brooklyn, a community of, it was a beautiful community, but it had become the world headquarters of the Lubavitch Orthodox Jewish sect. They located their world headquarters in the community, and with that came some very hard feelings about how they operated in the community. They essentially took it over, and they were doing some unusual things like harassing people out of the community, and very crazy things were going on in the city council, for example. The representative from that district was successful in getting the city council to recognize the community as being deserving. It is to have all the rights and privileges of an emerging nation. Imagine that. The Grand Rebbe had his headquarters right there, in smack in the middle of Crown Heights, which was a very delightful mixed community, lovely homes, and a great, great community. But soon there were all kinds of crazy things happening because of an aggressive move to literally take over the entire community. But I saw that in early mid, I would say the mid-1970s. There was a trial occurring in federal court at that time, and there was a reporter. She became quite well known, as a matter of fact, working for the New York Times, covering these cases, knew absolutely nothing about the court. And she would ask, well, who is that person over there? Who is that one over there? And I would literally, I took her over to people, introduced her to people. I took her into Crown Heights myself. I drove her around and showed her what this place looked like and whatnot. She became quite well known. But it was amazing. She was an African-American woman, by the way, working with the New York Times. And it just blew my mind that I felt very much at home covering this community. And it was as if she were a tourist, didn't know anything, working for the New York Times. So when you have that kind of a cultural blockage and you are nonetheless working for an outlet, a media outlet that is considered authoritative in its information, then what is your role? Your role is to shore up whatever it is they tell you your role is. And you come to the same process with the same disposition. You don't feel the need to understand other cultures. You don't feel the need to upgrade your information base. You don't feel the need to actually get out and see things and make sense of what's going on yourself and establish relationships with people. So we look at the news organizations today, and they are in full mode right now, especially now that the United States is revving up its rhetoric in Ukraine and against Putin and against Venezuela and other places. The role of the media, for all intents and purposes, is to safeguard this notion, the hegemony of the United States. They are now fully enmeshed in it for the most part. And you will know this because of the frequent use of the pronoun we. What do we do? What do we have? What do we want? How do we see it? What will our position be? This is the kind of stuff that you see. So media organizations today in the United States have a very odd way of assuring democracy, because the people who are telling us the news, the people who are basically controlling what we read and see and hear every day in the way of information, themselves are inadequate, culturally inadequate, informationally inadequate. And they see no reason that they have to prepare themselves for this this particular profession. They could just sit down and write stuff, but they don't have to prepare. They don't have to read. They don't have to have ready reference points about anything. And that's what you get. What, therefore, is the society to do? Well, we see that there is a huge growth in media, and we'll talk about that another time. I'm talking mostly about traditional media today. In traditional media, you still have this notion that first and foremost, you shore up the pillars of society, which are racist, just stringently racist. It is mostly a white male-dominated world. It has not yielded very well to the concept of diversity. And it, in fact, operates with the same colonial type of mentality, the same imperialist type of mentality as the country's military does. It arrogates to itself almost, excuse me, singular authority as the font of all information. And it has departed dramatically from, or maybe not, from its original mission, which is to report the news. Just report the news and get into what that means, reporting the news. People understand the correlation between having that power and the ability to shape people's thought patterns, people's behavior. You can control an entire nation by the way you use or misuse information and present information. And so we have, for example, I listened to a speech of his the other day, Reverend Jeremiah Wright, who was simply not at all anything like the media presented him to be, this rabid, frothing, racist, black racist. And how could Obama associate with him? And in fact, it is what shaped, in large measure, the outcome of the election, and certainly affected me, because it was on the basis of that that I stopped voting. Any president, any person who would deny somebody because somebody says you ought to do it, and if you don't, we will punish you for not severing your ties with this man, not only to separate from him, but to condemn him. That person, to me, is a coward and without principle. I can't vote for anybody like that. So I stopped. The media, in that sense, decided what the candidate ought to do. And it knew very, very well, because the information is available, except that they selected pieces of it to present a particular portrait of a person, to destroy this pastor who was very much operating within the confines of what the black church is a prized role, a role of truth teller. A role of liberation philosopher, a liberation theologist with a great gift of oratory, which we appreciate in the black church. But it was deemed threatening to those covering that that aspect of the campaign, and basically made him into a fearsome kind of rabid, hateful man. He's nothing like that at all. But it also compelled Barack Obama to step away from him and then to condemn him openly. Such is the power of media. You will toe the line, and we are in charge of that. He's been doing it ever since. You can't respect a person like that. The media organizations today are to be regarded with great suspicion. And a person really has to have all pistons working in your brain when you turn on that television, or you watch, you know, what's on screen, or you're reading the newspaper, or you're listening to radio. You have to have your guard up, because you have to be able to defensively listen to or defensively relate to media. They're up to capturing your brain. They're up to no good in some circumstances. They're up to some really bad things. Now, I'm not necessarily saying that this is the way it is all the time. I'm saying it is the way it is way too often, way too much of the time. So I'm going to be talking about media and media literacy, in an ongoing kind of way, because it becomes more and more important. I just want to raise this one example, and then we'll open up for calls. This flight, 370, that disappeared. The media decided, CNN, for example, and that's the one that I would point to as being most outrageous about it. It's one thing to say that this is a very important story, and it is. You know, almost 300 people just disappear, and nobody knows where they are or what caused them to disappear. It's a very, very significant story. But, you know, it's an interesting thing. Here is a news organization that allegedly should have contacts all over the world. And yet we do not see a single Malaysian telling this story. We see the same faces. It's mostly a white team telling us what's going on in Malaysia. And with a particular animus about the slowness of the Malaysians, the confusing nature of the way they carry on their government, their ineptitude, their lack of resources, how they can't handle this thing. Why does it take so long for them to find it? But meanwhile, people from all over the world are participating and they still haven't found where the plane is. But the arrogance of the media, the American media, the arrogance of the media is just so prolific and so in your face. But they discover that in the end, they still are no closer to the truth than the same people that they are talking about as being so slow and inexperienced. And all of the horrible, the ugly American way that people operate with, you know, as if they're supposed to know exactly what to do. They should have the answers by now. They should have solved this by now. Well, you know, you should have solved the shooting of John F. Kennedy by now. It hasn't happened, has it? And they bring in the information people, the information gatherers, and their job is to continue to hammer in this point that this country, Malaysia, is just so... it's just so disorganized, and the people are so backward, and they don't have this, and they don't have that. Look at us. We've got motion graphics. We've got all kinds of things. We've got maps. We have simulators. We've got people with expertise, and with all that they have, they still are no closer to the truth than the Malaysians are. But they feel compelled to reinforce to anybody watching these never-ending programs with the same conclusion: we don't know what happened. For more than a month now, they talk, we don't know what happened. That's the story. And so they come at this with that extra tinge of carrying the American superiority, American supremacy, even though there's no answer yet. But they also are, you know, the flip side of the coin is not just to prove American superiority about it, but to prove also the inefficiency of these Indonesians. They're just not up to snuff. Unbelievable. I'll stop here for a moment and take your calls. 888-874-4888. Let's hear a little bit more from Eliades Ochoa. That's Kase Madi Diabate singing, of course, in Wolof. Jay from New York, you're on the air.
Utrice, how are you?
Fine, thank you, Jay. How are you?
I'm doing good, thank you. Listen, you know, I was hearing you talk about the president and Brother Jeremiah Wright. I mean, you know, to me, that should have been the first sign to what was to come from this guy. I mean, the way that he handled that whole situation, like you said, throwing Jeremiah under the bus. But, you know, the question I'm at right now in regards to the president is, he's been in office for, let's say, going on almost 6 years. And if you really look at the conditions of the African-American community within the United States, there really hasn't been no type of improvement. I mean, if you look at education, it's not better. Incarceration, it's not better. Employment, it's not better. Health, it's not better. There's really nothing, it seems to me, that we have as a people gotten in return for him being in office, other than saying to our kids that in this racist country, we are now afforded the right to become the president. And to me personally, that doesn't mean nothing. But, you know, I want to know this.
We're talking media, Jay.
Okay. But I want to know this. As far as media goes, why isn't that, you know, people in the black media having called him to task for the condition that we're in as a people? And is there anything, truthfully, that they could do
to
call him to task?
Sure, but they are unwilling because of a historical nature, actually. They see this president as a kind of, how could I put it? This is a first. This is a first. Nobody wants to be the bad guy to attack the first African-American president as they see him. So they're very reluctant to do so, not because of themselves, but they're terrified of the reaction they'll get from the community. The community is very, very pro-Obama and would regard any criticism of him as, you know, a really bad thing to do. And they don't want to incur that kind of wrath. So they basically support him. They see basically that as a president, as a first African president, African-American president, he bears an inordinate burden. And if they had to make a choice, the choice would be to support him rather than to criticize him. And that's basically it. The community is a major role in this of overwhelming support for the president.
Yeah, but Utrice, you know, the one thing that you didn't mention and that maybe you should mention is that he has not treated the African-American press fairly. I mean, look at when he had his second campaign. He didn't put the type of ad revenue into their papers and radio shows that he should have based on their blind loyalty to him. So, I mean, you know, I don't understand how you could really take that position, even though, you know, you're saying it because there's a reason behind it, but he hasn't been loyal to them. They don't owe him any form of loyalty. I think they should really chastise him.
I do too. But we saw that also with Jesse Jackson. Jesse Jackson did not talk to the black press.
Yeah, but he's not the same, though, Utrice. Jesse,
but what I'm saying is that this is the mindset that, you know, controls the black media. And one of the things that they see themselves as, they see as their function, is that the white media would attack him, and so we will have to defend him. That's their position. So you're not going to get very much in the way of a very honest critique of the president. It's not going to happen.
Well, have a good day, sis.
Thank you, too. Thanks so much for your call. From Dallas, Sarah, you're on the air.
Well, greetings to you, Utrice, and the PRN audience.
Thank you. Same to you.
And it was nice to come behind you, Jay. I was wondering what had happened to you. I hadn't heard your voice calling into the show, so glad to know that you're still out there on the case. But, Utrice, on your situation that you mentioned with the media, I have not watched television, Utrice. It's been about 2 weeks now. I have not watched the television because, as you said, you're not going to get anything from out of this media but opinions, personal opinions, which are not facts. And that is what we have now. We no longer have informed, hard-hitting journalism on the air. And, of course, you know, the alphabet soup from Fox, MSNBC to CNN. You can't trust none of them. You can't take anything what they say. You're speaking about the black press and the black media. We have just become a carbon copy of the white media because all they do is they parrot what they take things off the AP and Reuters and they repeat it. Nobody's going out here and investigating nothing for themselves. They just parrot information, and they also have become very unreliable that you can't take nothing that they are putting out in print because if you read through it, all the grammatical errors, you know, this is something that anybody in a standard four English class would have picked up and say, no, we can't turn this stuff in because it would have been redlined. So it makes absolutely no sense what is going on out here. And as you said, with what's going on with this mess with this Malaysian Airlines, because they know what it is. The people who disappeared at the airline, they know exactly where that airline is. Whether it's sitting on Diego Garcia or wherever it is that airline is, they know exactly what happened to that airline. So all this theatrics that they're putting out here, it is just that. It's just theatrics for ratings to get people guessing as to what happened to this airline, which is of not importance. The president and what you have said with the black press and what he has done, all these people want to do is they want to maintain their access. They want to keep going to the White House. They want to keep getting these invites. So you're not going to get these hard hitting. They're going to throw dirt at each other. As I see, Roland Martin is out here talking about Cornel West, the verbal beef between Cornel West and Michael Eric Dyson. These are all privileged men who are sitting up in their ivory towers, making good money, and they're out here acting, you know, to see who can get the most spots on television. So Cornell, I can deal with Cornell because at least Cornell is doing something. He might talk a little fast and say a few things, but Dyson, he's out his league. He's really and truly out his league. He feels like throwing out here his multisyllabic words and sounding intelligent while fast talking is supposed to get people on his side. It does not impress me. His credentials does not impress me. So he needs to stick to what it is that he does best at Georgetown and do that instead of coming out here because they're not journalists. We need to stop getting these academic people. They pull out here and they put them on TV. They put a mic in front of their face. They guest host for some of these people. And all of a sudden, they tell themselves that they're journalists. They're not.
Well, I agree with that. I agree with that very much. It's a pity. Because it doesn't have to be this way. And we need to see we will see a change, and this is what's going on at CNN right now. They're trying to figure out how do we connect with or reconnect with the people we used to have, and how do we expand the base that we have now. It's people walking away in droves. So this is what's going on. Thanks, Sarah, for your call. 888-874-4888. Why is it important to talk about media in this way? It's important because this is a huge socializing influence. It makes up our mind, really. It persuades us to think one way or another. It tells us what it is to be are to interpret as the realities of the world. And more, we are losing control over this information because it's all over the place. It's being produced now in volumes that no one had ever imagined. Information is everywhere. And so you have to be very careful about the information that you accept. And even so, you have to ask questions all the time. You have to keep your guard up. You have to be suspicious of everything. This is a huge issue in America today because it actually influences more than the United States. I mean, I went to Jamaica many years ago, and I was stunned that I knew what was going on because Jamaica, I couldn't easily get Jamaican news. I could more easily get CNN in Jamaica. Jamaicans are more in tune with CNN. And this is the socializing effect that you have. You see people adopting cultural norms and patterns that are just not part of their culture, not part of their thinking. And you see people exporting this information. This morning, for example, Chris Cuomo said, of course, the Russians are causing the big problems. They're having provocateurs in Ukraine. And he was speaking as if he was dead certain of what he was saying. Hello from D.C. Mike, you're on the air.
Good afternoon.
Hello, Mike. How are you?
Great. I just wanted to basically chime in with two points regarding the medium. And my first point is, can I ask you a question before I do?
Sure.
Do you remember where you were at when 9/11 happened?
Yes.
And the reason I ask you that is because I have yet to ask anyone that question, and they not give me an affirmative yes. And my second point is that 9/11 was a psyop. And the reason I say that is because you had to, when you saw 9/11, you had to reconcile something in your mind that physically is impossible. You saw three towers get knocked down by two planes, which is impossible. So my point is that the media is a tool. And this tool is being deployed to kind of lull us into what I call the state of ignorance, where everybody embraces ignorance, and ignorance is applauded. Ignorance is rewarded. Ignorance gets you a reality TV show. And that's my comment. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And with those words, I think we're getting close to the end of our program today. I hope this has kind of started in your mind a re-examination of media, being very, very careful, especially now with media serving a multi-purpose agenda, not just about information, but about controlling information so that it influences people in a particular way, because when you think a particular way, you act in a particular way. So if they can shape your attitudes and can shape your thoughts and can shape your behavior, then they are doing a fantastic job, because they are in line with what Mike just used the word psyops. He means psychological operations, which is one of the military weapons used during war. It was, for example, when Grenada was invaded, the psyops unit stayed on for much longer than the troops did in order to convince the Grenadians that the invasion was a good thing and they ought to be really at peace with it. So the psychological operations, how do you shape a nation's thinking? You shape the thinking by shaping the information that you feed to them. And you hope, of course, that they never do due diligence and check what it is that they are consuming in the way of information. This is a huge thing in the United States. Information is big because information is power. And the converse is absolutely true. The lack of information is key to powerlessness. Lack of information or the lack of sound information is the key to powerlessness. I hope that kind of triggers an ongoing discussion we'll have, and that it kind of gets you thinking about media and watching how it is in overt ways they are attempting to influence the way we think and therefore the way we act. Thanks so much for listening today. Coming up next is Richard Wolff with Economic Update. You can send me a little note if you care to at leadstories@gmail.com, on Facebook, Lead Stories with Utrice Lead. Bye-bye.